today.
All right, you've got a lot of golf left to play for Tom Kim and buddies as well. They have a very international field here at the Zozo Championship. Brendan Steele with that opening round of 64. Some notables as well in this field. Let's hear from Xander and Ricky.
Yeah, it was one of those days where you could play yourself out of the tournament with the weather being pretty, you know, bad, I guess. It was supposed to be worse, and I'm happy it didn't rain every single hole we played. Yeah, overall pretty happy.
How does this set you up for the rest of the week? Does the game plan change tomorrow with weather improving?
Yeah, I think it's going to change for everybody. You're going to have to figure out sort of, you know, balls flying very short today. Balls reacting on the greens, you know, in a certain way just because it was so soft. So with the drying up and, you know, the sun coming out, I imagine it should firm up and play a little bit different.
A lot of good stuff out there today. Just had a couple squirrely ones when we had the rain come through for a couple holes, and had one on 17 when I missed the fairway there. When the ball gets wet, it gets a little tough. You lose a little control. But other than that, I feel like did a good job, drove the ball well, and playing from the fairway, with it being lift clean in place, it dry the ball off, and definitely gives you a lot more control when you're playing in conditions like this.
Yeah, when it comes down to the rain that you had midway through, I mean, what's important to focus upon and survive that period of difficulty and trickiness out there?
Big thing when the rain started coming in, try and hit it forward and somewhat straight. It can get a little tough because you can, off the tee, you can get some water on the face and on the ball, and sometimes it'll knuckle and go wherever it wants to. But unfortunately, we made double on number 11. But other than that, I had a lot of good stuff, like I said, and we birdied 4 out of the 5 par 3s, so that was a good addition to the card.
Well, it's a long way to the finish line from here, Damon, but we can also declare a winner after round one. Shirley, who do you think emerged from that first 18 holes with a little bit of a small victory?
I think Xander Schauffele has had some big victories of late, 3 wins last season. And I talked about it during the highlight how much I love his short irons in particular. Last season, he was 3rd from 75 to 100. He was 6th from 100 to 125 yards. We continue to see him play well with his short irons. And I think going into this season, I don't think he has necessarily the expectations. There's a lot of noise around some other players. Rory McIlroy trying to complete the career Grand Slam. When will we see Tiger? Jordan Spieth often under the microscope, not to mention PGA Tour v. LIV Golf. I think that Xander Schauffele can kind of go about his business. Yes, he has high expectations. I think he's one of the 2 best players without a major championship. But the way he finished last season and the way he started yesterday, I think he won round one. How about you?
He's really put that narrative to bed that Xander doesn't win enough by winning 3 times last season, including that team event. I look at a couple of guys with small victories there. Matthew Neesmith, it's easy to overlook how close he was to winning last week at the Shriners. He ended up finishing T2 when Patrick Cantlay imploded on the 18th hole, but he just couldn't get a putt to drop on the back 9 of that tournament. But he was in the mix all the time, flies to Japan, and suddenly he's in the mix again right off the bat. And this is a guy who plays a lot of golf. Mm. He plays 28, 29 events the last 2 seasons. And I also look at Ricky Fowler, that 3-under. It would have been very easy after he double bogeyed the 11th hole to go back to 1-under at the time, that the round would have simply gotten away from him because he's lacked the confidence. He's been a little wayward off the tee, a little flat with the putter for the last few years. But what we saw yesterday from Ricky Fowler, to me, is a sign of the continuation of what we saw at the Fortinet Championship, where he's a little bit better off the tee, incrementally better. Not a huge amount, but enough. And he's showing improvement on the putter as well because, he's currently in, I think on the PGA Tour right now, he was 161st with a putter last year. So far this season, he's almost in the top 50. He's 53rd on the PGA Tour. So at this point in Ricky's comeback, you kind of look for small incremental victories. I think yesterday was one of those.
I tell you what, when he was struggling with the flat stick, I even told him when I bumped into him at Kiowa, you have the best putting stroke in the game, in my opinion. And he said, thank you very much. And he said, listen, he did take some time to incorporate these swing changes. And he said, they just need to see the ball go into the hole. I think he's starting to see the ball go into the hole. And if he can get some momentum going, I think he's one of the best momentum players. When things are rolling, he can take it deep.
and the battle never ends in this game, Damon. And somebody with a lot of battle scars is joining us next. The Iron Man will be here. Dick Mast, he just shot 66 to qualify for this week's SASH Championship on the PGA Tour Champions. And that 66, will he beat his age by 5 shots? We'll be right back. Welcome back to Golf Today. This week marks the final event of the 2022 regular season on the PGA Tour Champions as Prestonwood Country Club in North Carolina plays host to the SAS Championship. The top 72 players on the money list after this week advance to the Charles Schwab Cup playoffs. And here's a look at that upcoming schedule. Playoff events begin with the Dominion Energy Charity Classic in Richmond, Virginia, followed up by the TimberTech Championship in Boca Raton, Florida, and then the grand finale, the Charles Schwab Cup Championship in Phoenix, Arizona.
Eamon, how about this story coming from PGA Tour Champions? Tuesday, 71-year-old Dick Mast broke his age by 5, made 7 birdies and 2 bogeys at Pine Hollow en route to a 66 to qualify to this week's SASH Championship. And how about this? Still a chance for Mast to make it into the Charles Schwab Cup playoffs thanks to the champ's wild card weekend initiative if he finishes inside the top 10 this week. And he's been at this a while, made his PGA Tour debut in 1974, 15 top 10s in 360 PGA Tour starts, runner-up Milwaukee 1992, 16 top 10s in 189 PGA Tour champions starts, entering this week 4 Corn Ferry Tour wins and that 66 in the qualifier. And Dick joins us now. It's great to see you, Dick. Take us back to qualifying in the round of 66. What was your state of mind before you teed off?
Well, you know, qualifying one-dayers are so different from regular play, and you kind of have to trick your mind into just playing golf in a tournament where you're shooting a number and enjoying it, you know. So it's definitely a challenge to qualify.
Dick, you made your debut on the PGA Tour in 1974. I believe it was at Torrey Pines or in San Diego. You shot tied for 16th. You've been doing this a long time. What motivates you to keep playing at an elite level in this game?
I come from a golfing family. My father, Ken Mast, was a club pro. He coached at a college in Ohio. I was raised on a golf course since I was 5. I've been mowing greens since I was 9 years old, on a tractor when I was 12 years old. Been around golf. And he was one of the best players in the state. He was left-handed, just a great player. So I'm a visual learner. He was very competitive. He'd go to a golf course and he'd always say, "What's the number one handicap?" He says, they'd say, "Number 15. He'd say, "Oh, I'm going to birdie that." He says, "What's the course record?" "Yeah, I'm going to go shoot that." And he did many times. And so I learned from my dad that competitiveness from being raised around sports in Ohio. And I've continued. I enjoy competing.
Well, where'd you learn longevity? You know, what's your diet and workout routine been like for the last decade or so?
Well, it's God's grace. But what I've tried to do to add to that is, you know, I like ice cream like anyone else, but I try to limit it and, you know, try to have a good diet. I take a lot of supplements. I try to exercise. I don't, you know, I'm not a gym rat. I'd like to be, but I do a little bit every day. Stretching is a huge important part. I wish I knew that younger years. But, you know, at our, when you're over 50, you atrophy in about 2 days. You know, you atrophy in about 6 weeks if you don't do anything. But you really have to stay on it and stay active and busy. If you're a bricklayer, you got to keep laying brick if you want to continue.
Do you feel as though you're an inspiration to golfers that high-quality golf is still possible even into your later years? Not just recreational golfers, Dick, but even the guys who are beside you there in the locker room.
You know, I didn't think about it that much until just the last year or so. I played some decent golf, and, you know, I was surprised at the attention it's getting. I don't think of myself, you know, to look in the mirror. That I'm 71 years old, but yeah, you know, it's goals are made to be broken, and I would like to break some of those goals.
Speaking of goals, it's an accomplishment just to qualify, but how do you set up your week in terms of goals now, knowing that a top 10 could get you into the playoffs?
You know, that's exciting. You know, I heard you saying it. It reminded me again. That's an exciting thing to be able to play. I'd love to play four events in a row. It's important to be able to play a lot competitively. That's the hardest thing for me, not being exempt to come out and play on this level. Now, I've been fortunate to be in a good section, Mid-Atlantic section. We have good players there, and I've been able to stay competitive, you know, playing once a week in a section of it, even if it's just one- or two-day event, sometimes a three-day event. I've been teaching at Poplar Grove Golf Course, where my son is the head pro. I'm the director of instruction, and so that's helped being around there. You know, giving instruction reminds you of things that you've done. And helps you to play better.
I'm curious, going back to your goals, Dick, do you have specific age-related goals in this game that you really have set for yourself, whether it's this year or in the years to come, that drives you forward?
I've had lifetime goals I haven't reached, for sure. And some of them are slipping by, it seems. I always felt, if I could do it over again, I'd do it much differently. I was I applied for a job a few years ago, and I for teaching, and I've been to over 100 instructors over my career. I've changed my swing 5 major times. I mean, major swing changes. It didn't have to be. If I could go back, I would see one coach, maybe two, and do it like that. I think I would have won multiple tournaments on the tour if I'd have done it that way. But you can't go back. But, you know, I've learned. And if I have health, I can still play pretty decent. I'd like to do that this week if I could.
Speaking of going back, and you said you can't, but I'm going to ask you to for a moment, because you've seen so much evolution in the game, golf ball, clubs, courses. What is one aspect of the game from a previous era that you miss the most, and why?
You know, I love the old traditional courses, the Westchesters, the Pleasant Valleys. Actually, the Pine Hollow that we just played the qualifier on is much like that. Dog legs, position, small greens, undulation. So I miss that kind of golf. And, you know, the length the ball's going these days has kind of almost ruined some of those golf courses. And I wouldn't mind seeing them having, you know, no metal, no graphite, no high-powered ball, and see if you can play both games. I'm not saying to go back to wood shafts, but that would be an interesting thing. But it's changed so much. You know, it's elongated. I hit the ball farther now than I did when I was in my 20s on the tour. I hit it 250, 255. And now, you know, I can carry the ball 270 with a good hit. So that's the equipment.
I'm curious, in the half century that you've been out there, Dick, and you've played hundreds of tournaments. Heck, we were saying the other day, you were on the PGA Tour Champions before Tom Kim was born, when we were talking about him a few days ago. Is there one tournament that you played in your career that got away from you that you still think about?
No question. Westchester. I was tied for the lead going the last round. And I don't even remember who caddied for me, but I needed a more experienced caddy to tone me down because I was so aggressive. The pins were all in the back. I hit the ball great that day and I shot 78 or 80. And I'm hitting it right at the flag, and the greens firmed up, and it was bouncing in the back fringe, and, you know, 6-inch fringe chipping downhill. I couldn't get it up and down. And so that's one that got away. In the very next week, I made 26 birdies in Canada and shot like 8 under. So there are a few that did. Yeah, Chicago, I missed a playoff by a shot. That would have been an easy one to win coming in. Yeah, you can go back and look at that.
Well, the good news for you, Dick, you're still making birdies. Have a great week in North Carolina. Best of luck. Let's talk again soon.
Thanks for having me on, and you guys do a great job. And look forward to talking to you later.
Appreciate that. 71 years young, Dick Mast. Folks, stay with us on the other side of the break. Phil Mickelson speaks to the media ahead of this week's live event in Jeddah. More on why Phil thinks he's on the right side of golf history after this. And the Zozo Championship's back in Japan for the second straight year after being played at Sherwood Country Club in California in 2020 due to the COVID-19 pandemic. A lot of talk about upcoming changes on the PGA Tour. Some of the changes that you will see upcoming starting this season, 12 elevated events, including all FedEx Cup playoff events, and the top players committing to a 20-event PGA Tour schedule, including those 12 elevated events, and starting in 2024, the Tour reverts to a January start. Here's John Rahm on these changes back at the Tour Championship.
The 20 elite events next year.
20 elite?
Well, the elevated events, the new schedule.
20?
Well, the 12 and then the four majors, the players.
Oh, well, I mean, majors and players and playoffs don't really count, do they? I mean,
is that asking a little bit more of the European guys, considering you have to play for the Ryder Cup?
Well, we have to play all of them.
Play all of the 20.
If we have to play all those 20, then yeah, 100%. I wouldn't be surprised if that changes.
Yeah.
Because that puts me in a difficult position having to play. If I don't play, if I go play in Europe in the fall like I'm going to, I have to play from January till August 20 times. I think this is my 17th from January, and I don't think I could add any more. Especially with Ryder Cup and having to play four in Europe, yeah, I think it's a bit of an ask. And I wouldn't be surprised if they revise a bit of a rule or make an exception for some players.
Yeah.
But if they do it for players like me and Rory, they might have to do it for everybody. So.
Yeah, thank you.
You know something we don't?
In what sense?
In terms of changing the policy?
Me? No. You're asking the wrong guy. If you want to know about that stuff, you know who of the two players you have to ask.
Soundbite always makes me chuckle how incredulous John Rahm was. 20? Here's Jack Nicklaus to the AP on the proposed changes. I'm not sure what to make of it yet. I think the Tour was going to get there, but the live thing pushed them. That's pretty obvious. What it's done is made the PGA Tour almost two tiers. All of a sudden, the other tournaments become feeders. Jack, have a point, Eamon.
Yeah, but I think that's also just codifying what has always been the reality, and it was the reality in Jack's prime as well. If you look at Jack's great decade in the 70s, the Tour averaged 45 events a year. Jack averaged 17 starts a year. What did that say for the other 28 events a year that Jack wasn't there? And Arnie's schedule is very much similar as well. And I think the goal here is to reduce the dilution of the product that had happened, because when you look at the top 20 guys in the world, the number of times outside of the majors and the Players' Championship that those guys are in the same field is tiny. They might have shown up and been there for the first playoff event in the FedEx Cup playoffs. They might show up for the match play. And once in a while, you might see them somewhere else. But really, it wasn't a guaranteed product at all. And I think creating this tiered system is only problematic if it's permanently tiered to the disadvantage of other tournaments. And there's an option here for the PGA Tour. They have five yet to announce that are going to be elevated next year. There's nothing that would stop the PGA Tour rotating those five every year so that over the course of a 4 or 5 year period, every tournament would enjoy elevated status, because frankly, some sponsors aren't going to be in a position or willing to pony up the extra money that it's going to take to get elevated status. And that's a significant amount of money. And if you're working at the Tour, they're burning the midnight oil now, because trying to figure out this puzzle, it looks easy when we saw that full screen there of the changes that are coming. But if you've decided what events you want to see elevated, you got to get the sponsors on board with the money. You got to figure out if the date actually works then. You got to figure out the pacing of the season schedule.
You got to spread them out. You got to spread. You can't have,
a glut
four
somewhere
in a month. I completely agree.
And then you got to go to your broadcast partners and say, well, can you take that event on that date? And they suddenly tell you, well, no, we have a commitment to a football game on that date for years in advance. They know what their sporting schedule is. So it's a tremendous puzzle to put together. But the end goal is right. But, I mean, what do you think? Do you think this is, when you look at this idea of a tiered system, it's fine to talk about what's at the top tier. You don't have to worry about those. When you look at the other events, which is most of them, do you see opportunity for those events, or do you see an obstacle for those events to overcome?
I see an opportunity, because even when Tiger was height of power, there was kind of the Tiger Tour and the events he would play and the ones that he wouldn't play, and you kind of had to figure out these sponsors, these tournament directors, what can I do to attract the best players? Take the Zurich Classic, for example, by becoming a team event, and some might say, well, I don't enjoy the team event, but you know what they get? They get buddies that want to play together. You get Patrick Cantlay and Xander Schauffele wanting to play together, or Sam Burns and Billy Horschel, or maybe Sam Burns and Scottie Scheffler at some point. You got John Rahm and Ryan Palmer wanting to play together. You had some natural pairings in Zurich, which maybe didn't have a strong field in the past, got some better players. You know, if you're in Hartford, you know, at the Travelers, your volunteers are known as being the best. And the perks for the wives, maybe, or the caddies, or a great finishing area, a great amphitheater, not to mention, you know, increased purses. You do something different if you can. I think it's an opportunity for some of these tournaments to try to sell themselves and figure out a way to attract the best players in the world.
Does it then bring up this issue of reinventing yourself again if you're Zurich and you find a way to get some traction to differentiate yourself? But if you wanted to become an elevated event, Zurich, at some point in the coming few years, are they going to elevate a team event?
Yeah.
And so, you know, there are a lot of puzzle pieces here that create another puzzle every time one of them is solved. And Jack's interest in it is on either end of the scale. The Memorial has already been announced.
Protected.
As an elevated event there, but Jack's charities also benefit from the Honda Classic down in Palm Beach Gardens, which is not elevated, and that's been getting squeezed for several years. Yeah. It was on a tremendous high for a number of years, getting a better field every year. Now it's kind of plateaued and dropped off, even from guys who live in town, because it's squeezed on the calendar with where it is. It's also a golf course a lot of them don't enjoy getting beaten up by before they then go to Bay Hill and the Players, but it's a tough point in the schedule. So it's kind of a blank slate the tour is working with now, and there are going to be winners and losers in that slate. It's an interesting thing to see. It's going to be maybe the most fascinating schedule the tour has put out in many, many years when we see where these pieces fall and which tournaments are eager to step up to the plate and be elevated.
The best players in the world were not competing against each other enough outside of the major championships. I think the fact that the tour and the best players in the world recognize that and have worked together to change that, I think that's a positive for the game. How about someone who used to be on the PGA Tour, Phil Mickelson, playing in Jeddah on LIV Golf this week, saying of LIV Golf and the PGA Tour for a long, long time, my 30 years on the PGA Tour, pretty much all the best players played on the PGA Tour, at least for the last 20 years. That will never be the case again. I think going forward, you have to pick a side. You have to pick what side do you think is going to be successful. I firmly believe that I'm on the winning side of how things are going to evolve and shape in the coming years for professional golf. He went on to say, until both sides sit down and have a conversation and work something out, both sides are going to continue to change and evolve. I see LIV Golf trending upwards. I see the PGA Tour trending downwards. And I love the side that I'm on. Phil Mickelson was really kind of under a rock for months, and now we hear him opening his mouth. What do you make of what he had to say?
I watched the video of the press conference earlier, and it really did look like that's what selling your soul looks like out there. It's a narcissist who's trying to reconcile himself to his gilded irrelevance in this game, because Phil essentially turned it into an argument over nomenclature, whether or not he gave an interview to Alan Shipnuck in which he harshly criticised accurately the Saudi Arabian government earlier this year. Now he says, I didn't give an interview. And that's what a lot of the focus of this has been on. And that's pure gaslighting from Phil, because it's not disputed what he said. He apologised for what he said, therefore acknowledging that he said it. The only people he actually apologised to were the only people he told the truth about, actually, at the time, which was the Saudis. But it's a diversion tactic, in a way, because he's standing in Jeddah in front of people who have essentially wasted more than $1 billion so far on this enterprise, and they don't want to be told that it's struggling to gain traction. So he's creating this alternate reality in which LIV is thriving, in which the audience is clamoring for the product, in which TV executives are hurdling the furniture to try to offer them deals, none of which is actually true. So it really is creating an alternate reality out there. And you've seen it now. There's just an air of desperation about the LIV guys around the idea of the official world golf rankings and trying to create this momentum that the product itself doesn't appear to be getting. And the stench of that desperation is rising fast.
After Phil made those comments over the winter, they were revealed by Alan Shipnuck of the Fire Pit Collective, you know, where Phil acknowledged that I am hitching my trailer to a group of people that have a horrible human rights record against women, against gays as well. But I'm doing it for leverage, he said. It was just such a weird statement to make. And then he says, I'm going to go disappear for a while and become a better man and a better person. And now he reemerges, you know, in bits and pieces. We saw him at the U.S. Open, and we see him now. Has he emerged any different from when the case where he was, you know, unseen from and unheard from on social media or anywhere?
He hasn't said or done anything in that time that would suggest that Phil isn't the Phil that everyone has known for years. I think what was interesting also in the comments we just saw was Phil saying that it's time to choose sides. You can't really say it's time to choose sides and then turn around and say, well, it's time for everyone to have a conversation. If Phil's drawing that line saying it's time to choose sides, okay, chosen sides, why did you then launch a lawsuit to cherry pick from the other side at the same time? I mean, he then dropped out hoping that he could avoid deposition time, which won't actually save him from any deposition if it does get to that stage. But Phil was the primary litigant for Liv in that lawsuit, the antitrust lawsuit that was filed, that he's now taken himself out of. That isn't a man who has chosen sides and walked away. Others have walked away. You know, Dustin Johnson resigned his membership, walked away. Brooks Koepka, not part of a lawsuit, walked away. A lot of guys did what Phil said. They chose a side. Fair enough, choose your side, do what you wish. But Phil is basically saying that it's time to do exactly what Phil himself has failed to do.
To me, it's the lack of gratitude. I just can't get over how quickly he has burned the bridge after building some remarkable goodwill as one of the ambassadors of this game, one of the most popular players of this game. And maybe it's because of some bad NFL bets, and he acknowledged that he had some gambling issues. But my goodness, to just burn down the house or to try to burn down the house that you were a large part of helping build, and the goodwill that he had, and just to fritter it all away for a stack of cash, man, it just makes my skin crawl, if I'm honest.
I think that's probably why Phil had a harsher reaction from other players than almost anybody else who went to Liv, because there was a perception from the public comments he made to John Huggan originally in February in Saudi Arabia, which came out a couple of weeks before the Shipnuck comments came out. It created this perception that Phil was actively trying to torch the house that these other guys were still living and working in. And I think that created a certain animosity towards Phil in particular that hasn't really diminished much over the 6-8 months since then. And his current comment saying that he sees their tour trending down while his is trending up, despite all evidence to the contrary, it's probably not going to improve his standing a great deal.
What will Phil do next? That means a lot differently now than it did some 10, 15 years ago during that ad campaign. Folks, it was crunch day on Sunday over on the Epson Tour as players battled for a chance to earn LPGA Tour cards for 2023. We'll meet one of the grads when Golf Today returns.
The Epson Tour Championship was held in Daytona Beach over the weekend. Players who finished in the top 10 of the season-long money list at the conclusion of the event earned their 2023 LPGA Tour cards. And here's a look at the 10 graduates who are headed to the LPGA Tour. The list was topped by Sweden's Linnea Strom, who joined us on the show last week. You see number 3, Lucy Lee, a familiar name from qualifying for the US Open at Pinehurst all those years ago. And Gabby Fenn, who joined us yesterday on the show. She finished 7th on this list, Damon.
Eamon, number 8 is 22-year-old Gina Kim. First pro win came at the Innova Mission and Inn Resort and Club Championship. She's had 7 additional top 20 results as well. A lot of success already in her young career. Qualified for 2019 U.S. Women's Open. Finished T12 for low amateur honors. Member of the victorious Team USA at the 2021 Curtis Cup, 2021 Arnold Palmer Cup, and she captured the 2021 ACC Championship. Individual title score 10 under par, matching Duke's lowest 50 for a whole ledger. In the event, she joins us now. Gina, congrats. Your career has seen a lot of success already. What are you most proud of in earning this LPGA Tour card?
Hi. I'm just so proud of myself for just going through the whole experience as a rookie and just having the determination to really grind it out and achieve my ultimate goal, which is to keep my card for next year. So I'm just really happy with the way things turned out.
How nervous was the weekend for Eugenia at the Epson Tour Championship to finally know you had secured that eighth place out of 10 to get the card?
Oh, gosh. I mean, it feels surreal. Obviously, I had my eyes on it for a long time, but I think the moment where it actually happened and they gave us the card and the champagne bottle, it took a while to sink in, to finally realize that I had achieved my goal for this year. So it felt great. It was nice to see some tangible results from my hard work.
Gina, you said you were impatient in your first 4 months as a pro, trying to make something happen, maybe not celebrating the small wins. What was that process like for you?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely was very impatient. I wanted to see some results. And obviously, I missed a lot of cuts in the beginning, including at my third Epson event. I just kept missing cuts. And, you know, I told myself, maybe this isn't really working out right now. We need to change the mindset, change the game plan. And I think, like you mentioned, staying in the present and celebrating those little wins really helped me kind of keep climbing up and keep adding those little wins to make this achievable goal happen.
I'm curious about this impatience, Gina, because you achieved a lot early. You've played multiple major championships. You were low amateur, US Women's Open. You set an all-time record at the time for the lowest round ever shot by an amateur in the first round of that US Open. Did that give you a sense that success would come fast at every stage of your career and you had to learn that patience this year with a few hard knocks?
Yes, absolutely. Being able to play my way into those positions helped me understand that, you know, I do have the game to be out here, and I was confident enough that it was going to happen. I just didn't know when. And that question of when is it going to happen really bothered me a little bit at the beginning of the season. But, you know, I think going through the whole experience as a rookie and understanding that I may not know everything, and just trying my best with the knowledge I have, I think that's really helped me stay focused on what's important. And, you know, even if the results don't reflect that, just the fact that I'm trying my best has helped me keep some peace and some sanity for the rest of the season.
Gina, I read an article. I want to make sure this is right. Mom on the bag for the Epson Tour win, Mission Inn Championship. Was that correct? And what was it like, if so?
Yeah, my mom was on the bag with me when I had my first Epson win. But she was actually there. She was caddying for me at stage one of Q School, and I won there. She's caddied for me at North and South, and I won there too. So I was like, well, Mom, you got a pretty good track record. So if you want to grab that bag and push it along and just stick with me for the 3 days, I think we're going to do well. And it came out to be a pretty satisfying result. So whenever I came back to the Epson Tour, I would have my mom caddy for me, which was pretty nice to be comfortable and just to remember kind of the principles that I play my golf with. And it worked out great.
Gina, I read another article. Your parents are UNC professors in the Romance Language Department teaching Spanish, and you ended up somehow at Duke. Is that true? How did you guys make that work?
It's kind of funny. I was a huge UNC fan when I grew up. You know, love to watch the Tar Heels just win national championships. I think when I went into the recruitment process, I started to look around, and I just loved Duke the minute I stepped foot on campus. It just felt like home. Everything I needed was there. And, you know, surprisingly, my parents were very supportive of it. They said, you know, if it makes you happy and you feel like you're going to excel there, then we have no problems. Obviously, they had a bit of a preference, but, you know, whatever makes their daughter happy, it was good enough for them. So I'm very grateful to them.
Gina, you're on this high point now where you're in eighth place. You got your card. The difference between the player in 10th place who got their last card on the Epson Tour and the person in 11th who didn't get the card was less than $1,800. Did you ever allow yourself to think of what plan B was going to be if you were on the wrong side of that cut line?
You know, I thought about it, and that was partially the reason why I had trouble sleeping the last night. You know, just thinking, wow, like, it's very cutthroat out here, and it's really by a small margin. And obviously, I'm glad that I'm on the right side, but I think later on, just knowing that I didn't play a full season on Epson, I was in a unique situation where I spent half of my time on LPGA and half my time out on the Epson tour. Just understanding that I did my best, and you know, if it didn't turn out well, I could always go back to Q Series, and it wasn't the end of the world, because I've already went through it last year. And I think just by having that knowledge and experience of what it's like, I was already in a better position than as an amateur last year. So, you know, I just kind of had the it is what it is mindset and just went for it. And it turned out great.
Lots to be proud of, Gina. Congratulations. Best of luck in 2023. Don't be a stranger. We'll speak to you soon.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Back on Golf Today, PGA Tour in Japan this week for the Zozo Championship. Coverage again 11 p.m. tonight on Golf Channel. I'm having a tough time. I'm going to stay up late to watch some golf, but I suggest it, you know, Thursday night. Want to watch a great city, watch some great golf. 11 p.m. Eastern time right here on Golf Channel. The talk of the golf world recently has been LIV Golf's attempts to secure world ranking points for their tour. Here's a look at the criteria for the OWGR securing world ranking points. Competitions contested over 72 holes, except for developmental tours. 36-hole cut, whether playing 54 or 72 holes. Average field size of 75 over the course of the season, and open annual qualifying schools. So let's hear from Xander and Victor Hovland in Japan.
I think it's something that's was to be expected. They're, you know, starting up their own tour, and to legitimize themselves, they need world ranking points.
So I don't know all the different regulations and how difficult it is to get world ranking points. So I just think at the end of the day, if you want to get world ranking points, you obviously have to follow the process. And I think they're obviously making an effort to get those points, but I don't think it's right to give them an exemption to just get points overnight. They obviously have to follow the process, whatever the process might be. But at the same time, you know, they have some really good players over there, and if some of those players drops outside the top 100 in the world, you know, that's not good for the world rankings either. So I don't really know what the right answer is, but you can't just make up new rules as you go.
Defending Zozo champ Hideki Matsuyama also weighed in on the world ranking points. Personally, I think they should be able to, in terms of LIV players being able to earn them. However, there's a procedure that they have to follow, too, with the ranking points. Now, this week, players in the LIV field in Jeddah gave their thoughts on the official World Golf ranking as well.
We all agree, and I think, you know, most people in world golf would agree that, you know, the field out here is to a certain strength now where, you know, it's impossible to ignore the talent that's out here. I mean, this guy standing in the middle of the three of us, if his world ranking is inaccurate, then the whole system's inaccurate, you know. So, you know, the only assurances that we get from LIV is that we're ticking all the boxes that we can tick and, you know, continue to do what is necessary for the OWGR to look at us the right way. And, you know, hopefully it's inevitable, but, you know, the longer it goes on, the games that are being played, you know, we're all we want is a kind of a fair court, if you like, and, you know, to recognize exactly that it is, what it is that we're doing out here. And, like I said, I feel like LIV tried to do everything they possibly can to be legitimate in the eyes of the OWGR. I mean, we've got some quality players out here. And to me,
thank you, Graham.
You know, the world rankings, so, Harold, love you lots. You know, the word official has to go away from OWGR if they don't take care of the players that are playing out here.
That was unbelievable, Graham.
Thanks.
Well said.
For me, I think we knew what we were getting into. I think it's easy to sit here and say what could happen, what should happen. But, you know, obviously, you know, for me, I knew what was going to happen. You know, like, it wasn't going to be easy. And I think the people at LIV have done an unbelievable job of just trying to, because I don't know the check marks. I could, you know, honestly, I could care less. I knew exactly what was going to happen. I knew what could happen in my career, and, you know, I accept that, you know, and I've had a great time out here. So, like, the world ranking thing is, you know, it's just been a part of golf for so long, and now all of a sudden, you know, some feathers have been ruffled, so it's, like, kind of just awkward. It's funny, though, I think, but it is what it is.
The guys over in Jeddah, Eamon. So here's G-Max saying, you know, you can't ignore the quality of the man standing next to me with his 24 PGA Tour wins, including two major championships.
True, but you can't ignore the strength of the field in the Seminole Pro member every year either, and they're not getting world ranking points either, Damon. As you saw from the other players, Hideki, Victor Hovland, Xander, there's a process here. And when Graham McDowell says that LIV Golf is attempting to check every box, that's clearly not true. Let's just even start with the idea of the qualification process where players can make their way onto that tour. The whims of Greg Norman do not constitute a qualification process, and that's ultimately what determines whether or not a player makes it onto LIV is his misuse of someone else's checkbook. And that's even aside all the other criteria. And there is a process here. It's very possible that at some point LIV Golf might get world ranking points. If they meet the criteria that's laid out, they should get those world ranking points. But the problem is they have not yet met that criteria, but they seem to believe that they can just bypass the process, and that the application of established rules is somehow a conspiracy against them when they're asked to meet those rules.
They want to be fast-tracked because their numbers are not just in danger of sinking, but they are sinking. Is that what this is about as well? Yes, they want to say, look at us in terms of the quality of players we have, but it also seems like they want this done yesterday.
The desperation is becoming more apparent. July 6th is when the LIV application was filed with the official World Golf
July ranking. 6th, 2022. Okay.
And it was a week later when Greg Norman started demanding his points, knowing that the process typically will take a year to 2 years, and that process includes the tour being compliant for a year with the guidelines, which LIV isn't. So that year clock really shouldn't have started even ticking down. Now, and then in September, some LIV players signed a letter to the rankings demanding that they be fast-tracked. And now you see this clamour building up again, because there is an air of desperation sinking in, because the rankings of their top players are dropping precipitously. It doesn't matter to Graham McDowell. He's so far down the ranking that it doesn't have any bearing on where Graham's going to play. But for other guys, it will have some bearing on when they're playing. And I think that's why you see this kind of... It's almost like an air of entitlement that you're seeing from these players now, that they are entitled to world ranking points, as though any group of players who get together and decide to set up a tour automatically are entitled to world ranking stature and recognition. And that's just simply not the reality. And you just hear these talking points trotted out as though they have any basis in fact. But I was really struck by Graham McDowell saying, all we want is a fair court. It's a hell of a statement to make when you're standing in Jeddah being paid by MBS.
Do you think that there is a route for them? Is it, you know, cuts? Is it, you know, a larger field size, which they don't even come close to meeting in terms of an average field size? I mean, just a couple things to get them there? I mean, would that give them the competitive heft that they're looking for? Because at the end of the day right now, it just looks like a very kind of high-end, glorified exhibition the way it's currently constituted.
Yeah, and the roadmap is there. I mean, the guidelines are there that other tours have met. And if LIV kind of reconstitutes how it is formatted, then the roadmap is clearly there to get world ranking points. And they should be given those world ranking points when the criteria is met. But this idea that they can demand world ranking points purely on the names that they have without meeting any of the criteria, that the rules simply don't apply to them, is quite something. And, you know, you even hear Greg Norman's anger about it is building up. I mean, he had a quote last week where he told the various parties who are involved with the world rankings, including governing bodies and majors, that they need to grow up, which is quite something coming from a man whose childish narcissism is paraded on social media with a fairly depressing frequency.
Do you think they're hurting their own charge, hurting their own efforts to be taken seriously and legitimately by, you know, for lack of a better term, whining about the fact that they don't have those points yet.
It probably doesn't improve an image that was pretty rough to begin with, but it starts to feel like a sense of intimidation at this point, that they're attempting to bully the World Golf Rankings into doing it by alleging a conspiracy against them based on the board members of the official World Golf Rankings who will ultimately vote on that decision. So they're alleging a conspiracy against them that doesn't have any evidence that it exists and hasn't actually been tested. But that's their way of trying to intimidate the World Golf Ranking into trying to avoid litigation and to avoid the perception of bias on their part simply by alleging it. It's just a pure gaslighting strategy that they're using everywhere.
Is professional golf going to survive this contentious year of 2022? Is this sport going to go the way of the dodo bird in 5 years? If, you know, we can talk about it on this table, and, you know, we got Rory in one camp, and you got, you know, Bryson and Brooks and Reed. They're all gone now. Is this game that we both love going to survive and thrive in 5-10 years from now, despite this contentious year?
I think it does. A lot of it's going to come down to what you mean by coexist with these tours. And I think there's a little grey area between what you hear some guys like John Rahm or Rory McIlroy say, and then Phil's comments earlier that people need to... First he said choose sides, and then he said sit down and have a conversation. Yeah. But coexist could mean you do your thing, we do ours, and never the twain shall meet. Or does coexist mean some kind of almost, not necessarily a merger, but a working relationship between the two? That, to me, seems much more unlikely at this stage, given the tempers and temperatures out there, than the idea that they could exist in different spheres a few years from now. But it really does come down to the idea of what does coexist mean. But that's not on the table right now, and the tenor of the conversation, particularly around the ranking issue, isn't going to bring it any closer.
Sports consumer has options. I just hope that the stakeholders in this game, you know, pay very close attention or very careful with the future of the professional game.
That's very true. Well, up next, we'll focus on a player who knows a little something about earning everything in this game. Lizette Salas is joining us. She's coming up right after the break.
And Lizette Salas joins us now. Lizette, it's great to see you. Your backstory is one of the most inspiring in the game. You had people doubt you. You were told Latinas don't play golf. What kept you focused and strong in the face of so many doubters?
You know, it's my family. My family has been my backbone since the beginning. And I've been fortunate enough to have teammates, coaches, and caddies who have become family to remind me of the bigger goal and to keep pushing forward. And, you know, of course there've been times where I want to, you know, throw in the towel and, you know, be normal, but I've accepted that this is a journey that I was meant to be on. And I'm just so fortunate to have my family come along for the ride, and no pun intended, the ride. But yeah, it's been an amazing 10 years so far, and I look forward to the next.
Speaking of that ride, Lizette, I'm very curious, how many miles were put on your dad's pickup truck during the earliest days of your career?
Man, I'm surprised that thing is still running. I mean, it's over, right now it has over 100,000 miles on it. That's my dad's prized possession, but we took several cross-country trips in my early stages of my career. And that truck's another member of our family. It might be passed down to generations, who knows, but it's that truck is a huge part of my story, and it became home for a long time. And I'm very fortunate and thankful for the crazy idea that my dad had, and it was all worth it.
You've talked about how in the earliest days of your career you felt unwelcome because of your heritage, because you weren't a country club cookie cutter kid. Have you felt that at points during your professional career as well?
Yeah, I think at every stage of my career, there's always been some sort of, not necessarily doubt, more of confusion. And my parents did a wonderful job of letting me know right off the bat as a young child that I am different and people are going to treat me different based on, you know, my skin color or where I grew up. And so I was ready for those challenges. And although it was very hurtful, I think my game spoke for itself and, you know, turned some heads and convinced the majority of the golf world that, you know, the golf ball doesn't see the color of your skin. And, you know, again, I'm just very fortunate to have my inner circle, the core people in my career, you know, my coaches, caddies, and trainers who believe in me and didn't want to change who I am. I think I stayed true to myself, true to my roots throughout my career. And again, I'm just very, very thankful.
Lizette, it can be a burden to be one of the few or the only one in a job or a role. As a Latina on the LPGA, how have you managed being unique while not letting it become a burden? Do you have times to exhale and just be and not always have to be a representative of?
Yeah, I mean, there have been stages where I felt overwhelmed with the support and wanting to do more. But I quickly learned that representation goes so far, and just the tour allowing me to be myself, and again, the people supporting that and loving me for who I am. And I think it just made it easier for me to just do my job. And I've seen so much growth in the numbers of Latinas picking up the game, young Latinas daughters coming with their dads to the golf course. I mean, it's just a beautiful thing to see. And, you know, it's unfortunate to not be the only Latina on the LPGA tour. You know, we're changing the current a little bit and we're giving, you know, some flavor, some spice, some passion out on the golf course. And I think this is the start of something new. And I'm, you know, I never thought I was going to be this spokesperson or this representation, but I take it with so much pride and I love my culture. I love how I grew up and, I hope the next generation will do the same.
Is that you're one of a number of golfers over the last couple of years who've talked publicly about the mental health struggles around this game, not necessarily just in a pandemic context, but just the demands of the job that you do. Mm-hmm. Are there enough resources at a tour level to help people with that aspect of professional golf?
Yeah, I believe the more athletes speak about their journeys or their struggles, I think it creates a bigger community, especially when I was going through what I went through. You know, the golf world had my back and I was able to push through. And we see that we're more alike than we believe that we are. And I think going forward, I think the tour will take a much bigger priority for mental health. And because as quickly as we can win and play golf, the next day we don't know what we're doing. This is a very tough sport, mentally, physically, and you know, I'm just, again, I'm fortunate to, you know, push through the dark times and have friends and family that, to support me. And, you know, I just hope that the next generation will have more outlets than we do.
Lizette, spring of 2020, there was a big push around the game of golf for diversity, equity, inclusion during the pandemic, post George Floyd. I'm curious, a couple of years later, what do you see on the LPGA in terms of diversity, equity, and inclusion?
Well, I think diversity and inclusion has been the DNA of the LPGA for a very long time. And it took the pandemic to kind of highlight that sort of aspect in the golf world. And again, just by sharing my story, I've been able to stay authentic to myself and be that representation and let the rest of the world know. And, you know, whether it's business or sports, that everyone matters. You know, everyone's story is worth to hear and to listen to. And I'm fortunate to have sponsors that have really taken that initiative to its core and in their boardrooms and you know, not and also supporting their athletes. So you know, the world of golf is changing, and I think it's a reflection of the rest of the world. And again, I'm just very lucky, blessed, and you know, I am very thankful for the job that I have.
Well, you carry your role with tremendous grace, but you're a player at the end of the day, a couple of straight top tens for you on the LPGA. How excited are you about the state of your game heading into this final stretch?
Yeah, I'm pretty excited. We had two really solid weeks, and, you know, I'm starting to get my stride back, and, you know, next year is a highlight year. You see a lot of red, white, and blue in the back here in my office, so that's a big goal of mine, and you know, we're seeing a lot of up-and-coming superstars on the U.S. side, so I'm going to do my best to be on that team. But again, with that breakthrough win after so long earlier this summer, my confidence is back, and my team is ready to work. And again, just fortunate for my team, my coach, caddy, trainer, everyone who has just been supportive throughout my entire career. I, you know, could have done it without them.
Lizette, thank you for sharing your story, and thank you for being so fierce. Best of luck the rest of the season. We'll talk to you again soon.
Thank you.